You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And today's date is the 16th of October, 2023. 2 days before my birthday, October 18th, 1971. And I have returned from my travels. Some of you, if you're relatively new to me, this program, you don't know that normally when I go away, for any reason, business, pleasure, anything, a major world event occurs. This started for the first Gulf War in 1990. I was on a cruise with my parents, and it continues. I go away the first day we have yet another war between Hamas and the Zionist state. But I'm all caught up now. Nothing is a huge surprise. I'm not going to be dealing with that today. However, I will be dealing with that for my Daily Nationalist for this week. Now, as always, I desperately need your financial assistance in whatever form that might come. My Patreon page, I have a couple of new pieces going up. Some of them are based on these lectures, some of them are not. But that really has become my main area for publication. Those who are putting my things on YouTube, I truly appreciate it. I just noticed that I'm all over the place. I didn't realize that before. These are the ways that you can assist me in spreading this message. Orthodoxy, nationalism. It's right in the title, is a message that we promote. And somebody today we're going to deal with is the great elder Paisios, now Saint Paisios of Mount Athos. Because he was very political, there is no doubt he belongs here. Many of you may be surprised that I haven't treated of his work before, and that would be a legitimate one. You also know that for the last couple of programs, I've been dealing with Martin Heidegger. We're not done with Martin Heidegger. We may never be done with Martin Heidegger. But we will return to that either next week or some other time. And I wanted to go back to the spiritual side of things with Paisios. And in fact, I had a talk written up years ago that I never gave. And I'm giving it right now. Elder Paisios is wildly popular among Orthodox writers. He has something to say that affects almost everybody in a personal way. He's not a party politician. He doesn't support one faction over another, which rarely goes well. But of course, at the same time, vehemently anti-ecumenical and anti-Zionist. But while he was alive, he was born in 1924, he died on July 12, 1994. So he is a contemporary of ours. And but people from around the world came to Athos to ask him not only about their own personal lives, but also prophesizing about what's going to happen. Now, as I've said before with Ignatiy Bronchaninov, I am not a spiritual guide. I don't have that. I don't have the level of holiness that requires. And I'm not pretending that I could interpret someone like the great Paisios. But I am approaching him as a someone concerned with international affairs, philosophy, and history. And he spent quite a bit of time on that. We spoke, I think, on our talk on the Greek military government. Actually, there are two of those. Fourth of August movement. We talked about the population exchange between Greece and Turkey following the war between the two in 1922. And he was born just before that. They were forced away from Cappadocia in Asia Minor, where they're from, and they settled in northwestern Greece. So this man was a part of so many of the negative things that happened in the 20th century. He was all his given name was Arsenius. He took Paisius much later on Athos. He also signed up as a radio operator, communications guy, during the Greek Civil War between the communists and the anti-communists. Because he had every intention of becoming a monk, he didn't have a wife or a family, and so he put himself in the place of those who did. He would rather be killed, and there were a number of soldiers who talked about it for a long time, and he was self-sacrificial in that regard. Then he had, and this is, I think, fairly well known, he made sure his two unmarried sisters were cared for before he left for Athos, because once you go there, it's a difficult life. I've talked about Mount Athos before. There's very little illness. There's very little disease of any kind. They do have a clinic there, professionally staffed with monks, but no one's ever in it. And their average lifespan is somewhere between 95 and 97 years. His first monastic name, when you go to any monastery, you're given a new name. And this is in the 50s, 1954. He was known as Averkius. And he was known as a relatively conscientious man. Self-sacrifice was always at the core of his being, which really is another word for love, so long as you have the proper motivation. But it was 1956 he received the name Paisius, as you were promoted up the monastic ladder. And this is roughly when he began to look at the world as a whole, and it's not to mention his own spiritual failures. Those two things are connected. And very much like several monastic movements before him, the lack of love was the problem, which is easy to understand given World War II and the Greek Civil War. And that civil war saved Greece from Marxism. So in praying about his own shortcomings, and as you grow in holiness, the shortcomings become clearer and clearer, he also saw more into the state of the world. He asked for a leave of absence in the very late 50s, because there were groups of Protestants coming from the West, especially the U.S., who were propagandizing villages. And what they usually do is they talk about how easy the Protestant life is. They have a lot of money. They're often CIA. They come with quite a bit of influence. And he went back to fight them. And in the process, he wasn't just feeding them the truth of the church, but also physically. And he always assisted the poor, whether he is on Athos or not. But then, as time went on, health problems increased. And despite his pain, I'm not 100% sure what he eventually died of, but it didn't make any difference. No one really knew that he was in pain. No one knew that he was, or thought maybe he was dying. You know, that combination of, well, no women and no driving, that in and of itself takes away a huge amount of stress. Lots of physical exercises. Tremendous sense of belonging. There's never real alienation there. And, of course, perfectly natural food. Later on, he was diagnosed with cancer of the lungs. But it didn't matter. No one really knew it. Those people who went to him for assistance. And he, by 1994, he knew his time was over. And he was buried at the Monastery of St. John the Theologian. Now, given the traditionalism that Pietro, really everyone at Athos, promotes, it is its own autonomous republic within Greece, technically under the Patriarch of Constantinople, and indirectly under the Greek government. But he was canonized in 2015 by the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, despite the fact that there were clear areas of disagreement. Now, a lot of my information on his particular views come from, I think most people, learn about him from his spiritual councils. And this specifically is Volume 2, Spiritual Councils of Elder Paisios, and the edition I'm using is from 2007. And a big portion of what I'm going to talk about comes from a specific area in that volume called Signs of the Times, from pages 197 to 218, but I'm taking from all over. But there is where you have the most social, politically oriented thoughts from him. First and foremost, it didn't matter. I mean, you know, he was on Athos for the majority of his life. Prior to that, everything was suffering and struggle. And so the concept of spiritual warfare, both within ourselves, as well as within the church and within the world as a whole, was the core concept. Of course, it's a very different kind of warfare. It's war in the very broad sense. It does have, obviously, physical manifestations, as he showed during the Greek Civil War, but also spiritual manifestations. Now, these talks, remember, he died in 1994, and these talks could have gone back decades. So keep that in mind. One of the first things you notice is that he's very worried that people not only seem to be living in ridiculous error, but they seem to be pleased with it. In other words, they're tranquil only in the sense that they don't know of any other alternative. He even says, this unsettles me. There's this reigning mood that, you know, the signs of the times, the ways of the times is all there is. And he calls it, and I don't know Greek very well, but translated as tranquility. I think he probably means something along the lines of self-satisfaction. And he says early on, I don't know what's going to come of this, and that the situation is quite complex. But right off the bat, he says the fate of the world depends on just a few people. So he's well aware of who rules things. But ultimately, no matter how much power this one group of people might have, God is far more powerful. God is far more in charge of things. And everything that seems evil now, or actual evil now, not seems to be evil, will be shown eventually to be turned around on the demons and showed to be a way of salvation. The very fact that we're Orthodox, most of us are Orthodox here, and that we've continued to hold on, however poorly we do it, is in and of itself a miracle. You know, how many times, especially to younger men, I've said our situation is very much like somebody who, an alcoholic, who for whatever weird reason is forced to work in a bar. He has no choice. And all day long, all night long, he sees people having the best time. He can't have anything. But they're having the greatest time, or at least you think so. You know it's going to get nasty in the morning. And people are constantly coming up to him, as if that's not bad enough. Saying, oh, come on, join us. When you get off, join us. Oh, it's all harmless. Come on, you're not really an alcoholic. Come on, we'll have a great time. And of course, what's going to happen? How many decades of that could you handle? And Paisios, he never used that metaphor like I do, but something very much like it. That spiritual life is one of pain and suffering. It, you know, when these kinds of images, and we've said before, demons can only operate, especially with Orthodox people, by means of images. And by that I mean images in our minds. But images in our minds also come from the web, comes from, you know, streaming services, comes from television, everything else. And none of that is really, we have no use for any of it. But prayer and understanding what pain really is key. The very fact that we're dealing with very complicated events and how different sources of power interact with even a fairly minor event, and so many people at varying levels of competence writing on it, we are overloaded with information and theories, especially when it sounds good. I mean, people lie in writing all the time. I couldn't believe this. And it took me way too long to recognize people make up stuff all the time. It's not just media. To avoid losing an argument, people do it all the time. But that means we're dealing with people who are just loaded with pain and confusion. And the result of all that is indifference. That indifference has something to do with what he means by tranquility. Well, we don't really know what the truth is. We don't know if heaven and hell are there. We don't know what the moral good is, generally speaking. Of course, when it comes to something like the Jews, then everything is absolute. But otherwise, we know we don't really know anything. That indifference, that tranquility, he says, requires a strong wind or storm that will blow it all away. In other words, an event of such severity, causing so much dislocation, that nothing will ever be the same again. I know I've used this metaphor too, but remember when the country was just drowning in zombie stuff? I watched the first season of The Walking Dead, and one of the things that struck me was that most of these characters were nobodies before. They had ordinary jobs. They were kind of just everyman. And yet, when they were thrown into a situation where there was no civilization left, where they were constantly being pursued, when there was no civilization to be had at any level, and only scattered bands of humans eked out a living as best they could, the best, these men who were nobodies before, became tremendous leaders after. And I think this has something to do with what he's talking about. It's going to require a severe shock for this kind of indifference and tranquility, so to speak. I think inside, everyone is just suffering. One of the great things about being a moron is that you don't have the capacity to really reflect a lot on what's going on. That's why they have such confidence. Either that or you're a sociopath. Sociopaths are confident in everything because there is no standard, good, bad, you know, true, false, doesn't matter. He says that the Tower of Babel is upon us. And he says many times about divine intervention that without the church, without monasticism, without the faith in God, we don't have a chance. He says the minds of entire nations are in confusion. But there is an upside, and that given our faith in God, there is a confidence in the rightness of our cause, regardless of what might happen. At least some Christian maintain the true lifestyle of what a Christian is supposed to be. And we sin all the time, and yet for the sake of those people, God doesn't end it. He tolerates things. And then he says, never be afraid. And he's looking at himself and those around him, and his spiritual counsels are often done almost in a dialogue form, where he's being asked questions and he answers them. Because we've been through many storms, and we still haven't perished. In other words, we came this far. We've been through hell. Don't be afraid of anything. Yes, there's a storm gathering, but just as we haven't perished in the past, we won't perish this time either. And immediately following that, He says, God loves us. Now, you know, many times I've concerned myself with what the word love means. And the only reason I worry about it is because it's used so constantly. And yet everything I know about love is nowhere to be found. God loves us. The point is that, well, God could be like Aristotle's God, or, you know, unmoved mover. That doesn't do anything, doesn't have to do anything. He has all he needs. He's a universe unto himself. He doesn't do that. He has created things and cares very much for that creation. And of course, the chief among them, after the angels, humans. So we're created after the fall of Lucifer, and one of the reasons that demons despise us, because we're going to end up, hopefully, where they were supposed to be. God loves us. It means he was willing to sacrifice himself, that is to say, Christ on the cross, from scumbags who really were so stupid. I mean, can you imagine if you're God? There's no way to imagine it. But the level of knowledge that you would have, you are essentially the principle of the universe. And you allow yourself to be mocked and tortured by people who have no idea what they're talking about. That's the most extreme kind of sacrifice you can make. And Christ says, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know I'm God. Although Paisius will say later that they did know, and the rabbis today know, which is why they're so concerned with sorcery and demonism. There is a hidden power, he would say, or a hidden ability that comes out, the best of us, in periods of extreme stress. It's almost like a semi-stoic understanding. God is above it all. We're members of his church, then everything is being arranged for our benefit. And we talked about this with Saint Ignatian. He rules everything. The evil will have to answer for what they've done, and they will receive their just desert. And he says, and I like how he words this. Now, I don't know Greek, but this is the main translation. He says, those who have in some way helped the cause of goodness will be rewarded. But then he says, those who do evil will be punished. Those are two different things. Those who have in some way helped the cause of good versus just those who do evil. In some way. Well, there's only, you know, a certain thing that we can't really. This is my gift, the level of knowledge and synthesis that I'm able to bring out. This is what I could be doing a lot of other things, I'm making a lot more money. I could have done what my father did and be far better. There's no way. I know what I'm called to do. And I'm hoping it's going to be sufficient, because I'm an awful sinner. Far worse than you, I'm sure. In other words, God puts everyone in their place at the end, judged by their own conscience, forbidding any kind of rationalization. And we're all going to have to answer for it. But it's for those of us who in some way helped the cause of goodness. And goodness is not just some saccharine thing like love, the way we normally define or use the word love. People use it constantly. Just ask him to define it. Get ready. Goodness is the Orthodox Church and the nation as a family, and your willingness to sacrifice for that. He doesn't mince words. He said, we're seeing around us every blatant attempt to destroy the church and destroy virtue, certainly to destroy the family. And he says, we're all responsible for it. It's not just those who do the destruction, but we're not doing much to strengthen it compared to what we could be doing. We all have a limit beyond which we're frightened, and that's the limit of our faith in God. And we all know what that is. I've said this about Sergius and the Sergians in the Soviet Union for a long time. It's really hard to condemn them when you wonder what you would have done if the gulag gates were opened in front of you and you were going to know pain like no human being has known it. But because we don't do the maximum, the regime, the Jews, are emboldened. And so their rage, and it is a rage against the church, just continues to increase. And we don't live in an Orthodox country like Paisius did. And he says that, and this is where it gets a little ambiguous, but spiritual means are the weapons, not worldly means. And that's where it, by worldly means, I think he's talking about calculation, being a controlled opposition, thinking that if we just elect the right people, we're going to be better. Spiritually, this has to do with your motive. He says the storm will continue to rage. It'll throw all the flotsam, everything unnecessary, onto the shore. And then the situation will become clear. Clearly. We could see the demonic obsession with inversion. The truth is turned on its head. Instead of the spiritual life being superior to the physical is made superior to the spiritual, and then the spiritual is denied altogether. Now he says this, now be careful and listen. In our day, it's a true witness to speak up for one's people, for the state is waging war against divine law. We are responsible for not letting the enemies of the church corrupt everything. Then he makes fun of some of the politician clergy. Oh, don't get involved with that. That's political. It's none of your business. And you don't have any power over it anyway. You imagine if people listened to that. And he talks about this type of clergyman. And he says they're indifferent because they want to please everyone and live in comfort. In other words, they can't deal with the divisions and the criticism that truth creates. Christ came not to bring peace, but the sword, because wherever you go, the truth will make you enemies everywhere. What's the alternative? To not say anything? How many of us could do that? But then he says this kind of indifference, especially when it's motivated by that kind of thing, is unacceptable for laymen and even more so for the clergy. In fact, a spiritual man does nothing with indifference. And then he quotes the prophet Jeremiah, "Cursed be he that does the work of the Lord deceitfully." This is one of many times where he talks about the holy war that has consumed the globe. We, he says, must be at the front. We're dealing with, and he talks about the Marxists and Masons, so many Satanists, and all these assorted weirdos, so many possessed anarchists, and those who the demons have seduced. I see what awaits us, and it's painful for me to even consider. But someone filled with spiritual love will feel the pain that's going to cause others, even more than it's going to cause us. So in that same sense, he talks about lukewarmness. These people who are constantly trying to be neutral. I don't take sides. There is no such place. Christian civilization is under violent attack. Everywhere you go, what's neutral there? Those who pretend to be neutral are automatically on the side of the destroyers. Speaking to us, he refers to this spirit of resistance, again with the right motivation, as manliness. The concept of manhood is also being destroyed. We've been spoiled. Over and over, this is a generation of indifference. How convenient to talk about the fact that we don't know what the truth is. Oh, there's so many theories out there. Oh, good, I don't have to do anything now. There are no warriors. Godlessness, blasphemy, you see it everywhere. It's the most mainstream thing. And the church does nothing. Now, in his case, he was talking about a Greece that has an official church. I have no problem with official churches. That means they get subsidized. But where the state goes, so the church goes. He talks about the need to excommunicate these people. Now, I said this as far as the excommunication of the Reds that Tikhon engaged in. It isn't so much that they give a damn what the church has to say. That's not what we're talking about. It's a public statement about who these people really are. We're not going to be living in peace. And people who normally would be on our side are silent out of a very convenient indifference. The whole idea, can I do anything to change the situation? As an isolated individual, no. But we're not isolated individuals. I know this sounds terribly self-interested, but even donating to me, you know, if you aren't in a position to do this, then at least help someone else who is. It doesn't have, you know, it could be many things. And the word help could be defined in many different ways. And he says, in these difficult days, each one of us must do what's in our power and leave what's out of our power to the will of God. And that sounds good, and we'll flesh this out in a little bit. In and of itself, those words don't say very much. But he lays it out in greater detail. And one of my favorite quotes from him, he says, if we don't resist, then our ancestors will arise from their graves. Here he's talking about nationalism because he says they've suffered for the fatherland. They suffered, they died, they lost limbs, lost families, lost everything. But what are we doing? What are we frightened of? The resistance, and look, we see what happens to people who resist. For all of his many failings, look what they're doing to Donald Trump. And he was resisting in a few areas, not many, but even that was enough. Being a leader today is something that's way out of my competence. You have to be a bit of a lunatic to want to lead. You know what your life is going to be like if you become a leader. Anyone who resists evil in public. St. Paisius predicts what our world is going to be. He's writing this, I don't know, 70s and 80s. He talks about churchmen. Well, they're silent and indifferent because they don't want to conflict with very powerful entities. And he says, if the metropolitans are silent, if the monks hold their peace, who then is left to speak up? He talks about manliness many times, in fact. The very act of, he says, pull yourself together a little bit. Think of your ancestors. How did you get here? How many generations? How much pain and labor made it possible for you to exist? You've seen the memes. You know, there's a Roman soldier on the one side, and there's some idiot in front of the TV on the other. You know, various versions of that. You know, it's been my position for a long time that Operation Barbarossa was sacrificial. There is no doubt in my mind Hitler knew he was going to lose. He didn't have the resources for the war in Poland. When he stopped at the gates of Moscow, it was because he had nothing left. Think of someone like Solzhenitsyn. Not only was he a gulag survivor, but he got cancer in the gulag. We're talking about love as a form of devotion. People use the word fanatic. Now, there's a lot of definitions. In fact, Paisius condemns it. But there's a good side of that. Fanatics are the ones that get stuff done. It's kind of like Gumilev's concept of the passionary. Someone who throws their own self-interest out the window for the sake of his brothers, for the sake of his people, for the sake of the church, whatever. There are people who have resisted the regime and live a relatively calm life. It's true. And they see this, believers see this, and they become emboldened. Anything that makes those who want to destroy us make their life more difficult is a good thing, so long as it's the proper motivation, of course. The church and so many others. People on the right side of things were victorious despite the fact that they are always outnumbered. The true church is going to be relatively small, especially today. A lukewarm clergy lulls people to sleep. They don't want to upset anybody. You must not get people alarmed. They have this false sense of love that somehow is identical with indulgence. No, we can't expose heretics. and homos and the delusioned, because that would be opposed to love. Love finds its truest manifestation in self-sacrifice. You would rather personally suffer rather than the person you love. And of course, he uses a famous biblical metaphor that there's no leaven in the church today. What did the old believers do? The old believers thought that they were living in hell under Peter the Great. Or little did they know how things were going to develop centuries ahead. And they were willing to starve themselves. They were willing to light themselves on fire, which is, I have to admit, a little bonkers, but that's how far they were willing to go. If we avoid upsetting ourselves to protect fleshly comforts, as he says, that means automatically that we're indifferent to God, we're indifferent to holiness. We're not talking about meekness. Meekness has nothing to do with being soft or indifferent. Don't ever, you know, there's this idea, you know, I'd go off on vehement condemnations of things when I had Facebook, and I was condemned by many people. How dare you talk like that? How dare you condemn this and condemn that? I'm not doing it of my own, because I'm a rotten guy. It's hard for me. I'm talking about the truth of the matter. Not even a matter of suffering. And I said, you know, what do you think someone like me is supposed to be? Christians are militants. Christ was an absolute troublemaker, as was John the Baptist and the prophets. That's why most of them were killed. The regime doesn't kill nice people. It kills troublemakers. We're not talking about indifference or being soft. That stereotype of the saint, someone with their hands clasped in front of them, their head off to one side. That is not sainthood. It could be. It could be. But that stereotype, and there are very few things in the world I hate more than that hippie Jesus idea, that Jesus wanted peace with everybody, and he was tolerant. Yeah. The Jews didn't murder somebody because he was harmless. The concept that because we're Christian, therefore we have to be joyous and calm all the time is nonsense. There's not a whole lot to be joyous and calm about. There are a few things, of course. Being in a perpetual state of anger and alienation is our lot. The joy that such people might have is not a Christian joy. It's a worldly joy. Again, very convenient. And he'll go so far, St. Paisius will go so far as to say, a spiritual man lives a life of nothing but pain. One of the reasons that you know the scriptures or the Bible is true, in other words, factually true, is that Christ and, of course, the apostles described a church that has zero worldly authority. You join us, you're going to be rejected by your family, you're going to be spit on, and you're probably going to be murdered. That was the orientation for Christianity at the time. And yet, they went to their deaths with this. Well, you don't do that unless something is absolutely true, that they've witnessed it. Can you imagine, you know, the early Christians going, the apostles going to people saying, this is what's going to happen to you if you join us. And still growing. The only way that could possibly be is if the events are in fact true. Preaching, he says, is not just a matter of abstract knowledge of theology, but also personal experience. I've suffered. Some of you know what I'm talking about. For years. Most of us have, in one capacity or another. What sort of person do you believe is created? And there are a few people like this. What sort of person is created if they've never suffered? If they're given everything they want, not just by parents and friends, but by the regime as a whole. There is a subset of women who are just that attractive that they get whatever they want immediately, just for breathing. But what sort of person does that create, no matter what you are? it creates someone who's extremely, not just entitled and demanding, but someone who's extremely immature. They're in no position to say anything about anything. There's nothing easy about this. What does God expect? Patience, prayer, and struggle. Remember, we talk about the passions. We're not just talking about the passions that well up in ourselves, but the passions that are engaged and all around us. It's like the alcoholic in a bar metaphor. It's not just that you have cravings. You would have cravings even if no one was around. But you're watching people have a great time, at least what you think is a great time. And they're even more, they're coming up to you saying, oh, it's all nonsense. There's no such thing as alcoholism. Now, I talked about motivation, and so does St. Paisius. There is a holy anger. You talked about motivations. Anger in and of itself, hatred, these are not bad things. They're neutral things. If you are angry and bitter when you personally are attacked and offended, having nothing to do with what we're all about, you know, the church or anything else, then your anger is illegitimate. Now, if someone is offended and angry because someone blasphemes God or Christ, oh, that's a different story. Not only is that anger legitimate, it's a requirement. Why wouldn't we be angry at something like that? Indignation can be righteous when it's indignation for God's sake, and that is the only justification for it. And let me quote the saint directly here. It's unseemly to become angry in one's own defense. Resisting evildoers, that's another matter. However, when it's in defense of serious spiritual matters, when our holy faith, orthodoxy, is concerned, anger becomes your duty in that case. And primarily because you're thinking of others. That's why this derives from love. Even if you know it's never going to affect you, you see the damage that's being done. And the church mocked. If you're not angry and bitter, there is something wrong with you. If someone calls you a jerk off or cuts you off in traffic, it's a different story. We're attacking blasphemers because you want to defend our neighbor. That is pure because it's carried out in love. St. Paisius mentions the concept of love many times. In fact, he has quite a number of speeches and writings on marriage. And there he does get into what love is. And he says, well, there really is no love in us most of the time. So we don't feel the sufferings of others, especially people we don't know. We don't feel sad or bitter because of the temptations that good people have fallen into. But he also says, especially for those in the church with us, we're not talking about vices being known to everyone. By exposing the moral failings of our brethren, we arm the enemies of the church. Only under extreme conditions, when there's nothing else left, do we make a public statement. Because every time we do that, we're giving the regime another pretext to escalate the war on us. And on top of that, the faith of the weak is shaken. Now, we should expect a lot of sinners and rotten people in the church, because that's why the church exists. Those who had been initially invited to the feast refused to come. God says, or, you know, the New Testament story about the banquet, the Lord says, just go out and grab people anywhere and bring them in. And that's us. Mending our own ways is very important. But everything comes down to your motivation. When we straighten our own selves and we get our act together, we're helping the church in an extraordinary way. The church would be perfect if everyone did that. But people attend to pretty much everything, just not to themselves. It's easy to teach others while you're not being tempted by that same kind of thing. Mending one's ways requires effort. Now, it's a silly idea to say that you can't criticize something unless you're perfect. That's nonsense. I criticize people for doing what I do all the time, precisely because I know how bad it is. It's all about motivation. That could be hypocrisy. Remember, hypocrisy doesn't mean moral failings or being inconsistent. That's not what hypocrisy is. Hypocrisy is when you don't believe in the moral standards that you're preaching to others. We all sin and hence contradict ourselves. We know what's wrong. But that's just it. We know what's wrong. Think of a politician who changes his point of view depending on the audience that he's addressing. That's hypocrisy. He doesn't believe any of that. That's the issue. We're all inconsistent. That's not the problem. That's just the nature of humanity. We want to expose certain people within the church without any love, only because of our own partiality, our own interest. And the person who's so targeted is just going to be absolutely enraged. It's a strike on his egotism that comes from our own ego. Our hostility arouses alarm. We're aware of our own personal sins. That doesn't mean we should stay silent concerning others. You just don't, you know, have a blog post about it. And he says this. He says, when we're about to say something in this capacity, ask yourself the following questions. What am I trying to get across? In other words, what do I want to say here? What is my motivation? Not my justification for it, but my real motivation. Do I really care about this guy? Or am I angry? I just want to show how wonderful I am. Show off for others. Appearing to be principled and strong. And we've come across this in many areas. The jurisdictionalism of the true Orthodox Church has something to do with this. And time has gone on. You learn so much more about the really petty reasons that some of these schisms have occurred. How much of this concerns their own advantage versus the abstraction of a theological goodness. But of course, that has everything to do with the will. Because of our state, and certainly being forced to live under this regime, people are normally influenced more towards the evil side than the good side. It's very easy to be evil, but very difficult to be good, in the sense of being virtuous. And unlike the alcohol example that I've used, he does the smoking example. Now, I don't know if he was a smoker at one point. There's got to be a reason. I was never an alcoholic, but I was a heavy drinker many years ago. The minute a smoker decides to stop, he's going to be tempted. It's in the very nature of demonic temptation to create excuses. Well, wait a minute, I don't have to quit. Maybe I just cut down a little bit. The alcoholic will say, oh, I just have a glass of wine at dinner. Well, why do you have a glass of wine at all? What's the point of that? Except you're allowing yourself a little chink in the armor to indulge this. Or cigarette. Hey, these cigarettes have less nicotine in them. And there's filters and there's charcoal in there and everything. Oh, we can smoke these. That's much better than what I've been doing. And he says, demons are capable of finding many excuses and many rationalizations and justifications for what we do. There are people out there who don't know how to look inside. They have no clue. Being introspective is hard. You don't like where this is going. But it's our duty. We realize just how brutal temptation can be, especially in 2023. There's a very famous quote from St. Paisis where he says, if you don't cut out our bad habits when we're young, then it's going to become very difficult later on. Well, we do have people like yours truly, many others who converted. I was in grad school People convert in their 20s, 30s, even afterwards. My God, what are we going to do? But of course, Christ is aware of this. Even St. John Chrysostom addresses this question. Now, willpower in and of itself can't be totally relied on. Eventually, you're going to give way. But the will still remains very important. The will has to do with action. Now, God, of course, is always benevolent. He desires our own good. But that's only half the equation. The other half is that we have to choose it. The total depravity conception of Protestantism is an error, since free will is gone in that case. Now, I do think that we are not born with free will. We're born with the capacity to free will. And only through the ascetic life can we learn how to not justify things, not rationalize things, but understand them for what they are. Slowly but surely becoming free. And the problem, when I say free, I mean autonomous. That is to say, unmoved by the passions. He says, sweet words and great truths have value only when uttered by righteous lips. A wicked person can make a true statement for all the wrong reasons. Truth has to be tempered with judgment in the same sense that the intellect has to be tempered by the will. We say true things out of empathy, which is one of the consequences of love. Not sympathy necessarily, but empathy. We could put ourselves in their shoes. Now, when Paisius uses the word fanatic, and again, I don't know what the Greek is there. I have the feeling there's a bunch of different translations for that. A fanatic is someone who draws these hard and fast lines. It's only my jurisdiction that has the truth. Normally, that's an error. Recognize those outside, even, you know, what we all recognize outside the canonical boundaries of the church have value. And it's up to us to show them that. Even truth, when the evil says it, makes these statements, even truth can become evil. Again, righteous anger. He talks about this quite a bit. You're walking down the street, and you see someone beating a kitten. What do you do? I don't care how big this guy, I don't care what's going on here. There's going to be a confrontation. That has nothing to do with us. I'd be on an autopilot if that were the case. Now, the anger that comes from if you are wrong, he's hurting an animal that it's yours. And the only reason that you're angry is not because the animal's in pain. It's because your property has been violated. Different story. Divine zeal comes from seeing someone suffering for the sake of the sacred. There's 100 examples of righteous anger. What did Moses do when he saw the sacrifice of the golden calf? He was angry. He threw things. These God-granted commandments he smashed. One of my favorite examples, Phinehas, grandson of Aaron, murdered 2 people, and God established a covenant directly from it. The perpetual priesthood derives from him. The Israelite Zimri was sinning with the Midianite woman before Moses and all the Israelites. He couldn't control himself. He killed both of them. And that's what put an end to God's anger. That is not only righteous, it's the way to sainthood. Even in the Psalter, Phinehas stood up, did what he did, and the plague was stopped. I think the most common one is when Christ beats the usurers in the temple. It was partially because they were doing it in the temple grounds, but also partially because they were usurers. We ascend through humbling ourselves all the time. The spiritual life isn't something for show. And we're surrounded by media that sensationalize everything in order to gain readers, to gain this personal interest. There was a time, he said, when the Holy Spirit enlightened us and showed us the way. This was an extraordinary thing. Today, it doesn't find any reason to descend to us. And this is why the future is so murky. He says the Tower of Babel was child's play compared with our age. It is very possible that, and it's of my personal opinion, I think the opinion of many of us, that we are within the times described by the apocalypse. Daniel, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and the book of Revelations, of course. That things are coming to the surface. We're starting to be able to put the pieces together. There is no neutrality. He says, madness has gone beyond all bounds. Apostasy is upon us. And all that's left is the rise of the son of perdition. Another quote here. A great confusion will reign in which each government will begin to do whatever comes into its head. And we know what that means in great detail. Even the most unlikely weird things are going to come to pass. And we can only hope that these evil times won't last very long. And he, you know, I don't know when he uttered this. Certainly before the 1990s. He says, ecumenism, common markets, one world government, a single made-to-order religion, that is the plan for us by these devils. The Zionists are already preparing their Messiah. For them, the false Messiah will be king and rule here on earth. Because of the nature of the confusion, there will be a clamor for someone to come and save them. People claiming to be Christ in his second coming. And what are the Jehovah's Witnesses doing? Waiting for the Jewish Messiah, apparently. But he also says the Jews themselves are fanatics. They do understand that Christ is God. To the extent that they take the Pentateuch seriously. We know they really don't. But they're blinded by ego. No one could be a Jew if they paid even a little attention to the Old Testament. And they do this by inverting spiritual meaning into material meaning. And he's citing the Talmud, although he doesn't say where. And I'm going to quote him directly. For example, you should see how they interpret the prophet Isaiah's, "The desert shall blossom." In order to show that the desert has indeed blossomed, they altered the course of a stream, built irrigation systems, planted gardens, banana trees, lemon trees, orange trees. They created orchards and gardens everywhere. So now they could say the desert has blossomed. Now he's talking about the Zionist entity. But they've been doing this for a very long time. That's how they interpret everything, he says. Of course, he's not talking about that. He's talking about spiritual renewal. The trials that await us are extraordinary. Our good friend Sven Longshank is in prison right now for absolutely nothing. And that's just the beginning. Many, even well-intentioned people don't see the end times in front of us. The seal of Antichrist is everywhere. And even the chosen might be deceived. And straight from there, he talks about Zionism, which is particularly relevant. The Zionists want nothing short of global rule, and they claim that everyone else wants to rule the world. And he says, to achieve their ends, they'll use black magic and Satanism. They regard Satan worship as a means to gain the strength they need to carry out their plans. They want to rule the world using satanic power. Magic is not a miracle. Magic is a war against the natural order. A miracle is merely the speeding up of the natural order. They hate the natural order. That's the whole concept of Gnosticism, to replace it. Tikkun Olam, as many of you are well aware. And he talks about, again, I think he wrote these maybe in the 80s or early 90s, talking about the Mosque of Omar in Jerusalem. How many attacks have these fanatical, lunatic settlers engaged, attempting to burn the place to the ground, to restore the Temple of Solomon, which is as much a metaphor as an actual reality. Jews don't really care about the Old Testament. They hate the Old Testament. The Temple of Solomon is, in fact, a metaphor, but this manifestation will be a symbol for everybody. And then in this rebuilt temple, that's where they'll proclaim Antichrist, whether that's actual literal or, as I've suggested, having to do with the spiritual entity of Adam Kadmon is a separate issue. He says the rabbis know that the Messiah has come and that they murdered him. Now, of course, we're not talking about the same people genetically. We're talking about the Talmud here and people who follow it, having nothing to do with the Old Testament. But because of their fanaticism and egoism and the love of money, they're blinded by all of this. And here is a quote, and it comes out of nowhere. He says, "And now a vaccine has been developed to combat a new disease, and this will be obligatory, and those taking it will be marked," meaning marked with the seal of Antichrist. He uttered this many decades ago. I don't know what he's talking about. Talking about a vaccine, and the vaccine is a way to mark people. He has a new disease, but doesn't mention what that new disease is. And the mark, of course, is based on the three sixes. That in 3 Kings 10 and 2 Chronicles 9, there is the concept of 666 as a the yearly tax. That's the yearly tax. That's many talents of gold. And that was when they conquered an area. Again, this is the worldly state here. When they conquered an area, that was the nature of the tax. And in order to conquer the world, they'll be using the same kind of numbers. It's the number of mammon. It's the number of gold, or the worship of gold, like the camp. And of course, everything is going as planned. I do believe that the Russian invasion of Ukraine destroyed the concept of New Khazaria. This attack from Hamas, and we'll talk about this more later on, I have my own set of ideas about it, is showing just how difficult, you know, Israel, the position that they're in. That number, we see, you know, 6 million Jews, all this, they've been saying for centuries, that number six is sacred. And that's how, St. Paisius says, that's how Antichrist will subjugate the world. And it will be based on the very same mechanisms that control the global economy. Because you can't take part in the economy unless you receive this mark. We know what they were doing. They've had some setbacks, but with the vaccine, wearing this mark. Even I thought that wearing the mask outside of hospitals, that was just a way to find out who's, you know, listening and who isn't. He goes on about the ID system. And he says, "But those who don't agree with the regime will have a rough time. They'll be constantly trying to imprison them using any pretext they could find." And now we know exactly what that is. They won't directly torture somebody, like strapping them down in a chair or something. They'll just make it impossible for you to function. They don't need camps. You know, they don't need all of these obvious signs of oppression. They're not stupid. And this is one of the reasons that it's very possible that Antichrist won't be an actual individual who claims to be the Messiah. That would be very obvious. They just make it very difficult to live. That outside of this tiny 0.5% of the population, living will be almost impossible. And people will come up to you. And I said this with the book of Daniel. And they'll say, "Listen, I know that you haven't received this mark. You haven't been injected," or whatever the issue. "I know that. And I admire you so much. But come on, just accept it. Just, you know, I don't want you to suffer anymore. Just accept it. It's so unreasonable. People are suffering because of you." That's how people are going to approach you. And then for our sake, he talks about the simple, moderate life under these conditions. A bit of land, raising food, planting olive trees. Of course, he's in Greece, keeping animals, whatever. We will be able to feed our family. And we broaden that. He's talking about creating our own cooperatives. Today, everything is crystal clear. No one's accepting this mark out of ignorance. I don't care who you are. You can't make that claim in 2023. The battle lines are drawn. You don't need an in-depth discussion. If you live in Germany and you see your country invaded by hostile, useless third worlders who should be useful in their own country, but they should be rebuilding, their countries would be North Africa, whatever. You don't need an analysis to see the destruction that they're causing, the poverty that they're causing, the crimes that they're creating. There's no excuse. The only reason you would think that's okay is because you either hate yourself, hate your people for whatever reason, or just want to curry favor with the regime. So there is no unknowing here. If by now people haven't did a little research as to this vaccine, if by now they haven't done it, they're not doing this unknowingly. They don't want to know. The truth can be painful. And at least for now, that is our life. And that is a thumbnail sketch into the thinking of the great St. Paisios of Athens. Thank you for listening, everyone. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.